did not realize how orange that lipstick looks on me. Oh, well, too late now. Hello, hello. Welcome back to Loki's Librarian. If you are new here, welcome. I am your librarian, Katrina. This is where I'm reading through the enormous library books you see behind me with my penis squid back in the corner where he belongs. And then I give you a quick synopsis and tell you what I think about them. So if you like books, just aren't sure what to read next, like and share my videos, hit that subscribe button, let me know what you think in the comments. It is the last Sunday of the month, so it is time for the next president, and this month is a doozy with FDR, a biography by Ted Morgan. It is 774 pages. I needed that vacation time to read it. I read an average of 170 pages a day. Super fun times. Like, my arms hurt from holding this mofo up. The accompanying cocktail this month is going to be a rum swizzle. It is 1.5 shots each of dark rum and gold rum, a shot of triple sec, 2.5 ounces of orange juice, juice from 1 lemon, 1 ounce of falernum, and 3 dashes of bitters. Just so you know, one shot is about 1.5 ounces, so 1.5 shots will be in about 2.25 ounces. So let's do this. There's a lot to unpack here. So Franklin Delano Roosevelt was born January 30th, 1882 at the family residence in Hyde Park, New York. Now, FDR was born of American royalty. Like, if we had royalty, he would be one of the royals that was born. My markation here. So the Delano family had initially made their millions in the 19th century, millions in 19th century money. So it was like gold-backed currency. So the legit rich people, right? In the 19th century by importing tea from China to the United States. The family eventually lost this fortune through bad investment, and the head of the Delano family, which I believe was FDR's grandfather on his mother's side, traveled back to China and made the family's second fortune importing opium from China to the United States just in time for the Civil War, when opium would be at a premium, treating the injuries of the wounded. So, right place, right time, all right? It was perfectly legal, so there was nothing wrong with him importing the opium like that. But, they were drug runners. Legal drugs, but still drug runners. I told my husband that story, and he said something like, yeah, that's about right. His family imported opium, and FDR founded the CIA, which would go on to import lots of drugs to the ghettos. And, I mean, I had to laugh. It's not quite accurate. FDR founded the OSS, which was the precursor to the CIA. But the point's valid. It made me laugh. It was funny. We're going to see if I'm going to be sad if I don't have enough room in this little jar for this. This jar is, like, made for this sort of cocktail. On the Roosevelt side, the Roosevelts came over from Holland or the Netherlands in the early 17th century, and they owned lots of land in New Amsterdam area. I mean, they just barely missed making a fortune on the early sale of land. I think it was the Astors they sold to, but it might have been the Morgans. But it was definitely one of the richer families to come out of the area. Purchased land from the Roosevelts that would eventually become Manhattan. Like, the richest pieces of real estate, like Fifth Avenue, Saks Fifth Avenue, that sort of, land prosperous purchase, just crazy levels of wealth there. But they just missed it. They sold it for like $25,000 back in the day. It's okay. It doesn't need to be more than that, I guess. But still, the family was quite wealthy on all sides and had roots going back to before we were a nation. FDR was the fifth cousin of Theodore Roosevelt and was very much impressed by the family history and was a great admirer of Teddy, even though Teddy was a Republican and he eventually became a Democrat. Now, his mother, Sarah, was the absolute picturing nightmare of an Oedipal mother. Seriously, she wanted to keep her baby boy close and at home always, and he had to fight her to get out of dresses, and understand, this was the normal clothing style back in the 19th century. It wasn't like a early cross-dresser thing where she wanted her baby boy to be a baby girl. She was genuinely pleased to have a son. It's that back then, all children dressed like that because then they could just pass the clothes on. There was none of this, oh, if it's not a boy, they can't wear it. It was all the same. But he had to fight her to get him to let him wear pants like a boy would when he hit like 5-6 years old. She wanted to keep him in dresses and long curls. He won, obviously, and went on to become a boy. His father, James Roosevelt, was 54 to his mother's 26, which was not unusual for that time. And he pretty much let Sarah was his second wife, have the running of the household. Theodore grew up basically an only child. In fact, I think he was the only child. I don't believe. Not only James had any kids other than than. Did he have a half brother? He may have had a half brother. I don't know. He may have had a half brother. Regardless, he was left basically entirely to Sarah's care to raise, and yeah, she was a controlling mother. He eventually did win that control, mostly when he was 14 and he was enrolled in Groton Boarding School in Groton, Connecticut? He was in Connecticut. And he flourished there. After Groton, he went to Harvard and then to law school, marrying Eleanor, when he was, who was Teddy's niece, on March 17th, 1905. Oh, this is getting very full. Poor fucking Eleanor. I mean, Sarah was controlling and domineering, building them a family home in New York that was basically a duplex, which sounds lovely, like, oh yeah, you're just right next door. Until you learn that this duplex didn't just have the front doors and then walls in between, and the walls actually slid back and forth so they could enter each other's residence without knocking at a moment's notice. And Sarah did it all the time. She was constantly entering Eleanor and Franklin's house, which drove poor Eleanor absolutely fucking nuts, and she had nothing to, she couldn't do anything about it, because when James died, Sarah controlled all the purse strings, and she used that money like always. She was very controlling with it. This jar might not be big enough. Okay, I'm almost done. What else is clearing him? Now, he caught the civil service bug from his mentor at Groton, which was the school founder, Endicott Peabody. And FDR chose pretty early on to go into public service. I mean, he did want to be a lawyer. He did certainly work in private practice for a while, not just as a lawyer, but he also went on to sell insurance after his time with the Department of the Navy. But mostly his heart was in the public service arena. Ooh, yikes. Maybe I should just fish some ice out of here. This is a mess. That's what this is. This is a hot mess. The jar is too small. I'm very sad here. If I fish some ice out, it'll be just fine. Watch this. Yeah. Drop, take the ice out. Physics! Basic math! My falernum is in there. Now all I have to do is swizzle the damn thing. You could put this in a shaker, shake it up. Or in a jar and shake it up. A swizzle stick technically comes from a swizzle tree. Are you fucking kidding me? My swizzle stick doesn't fucking fit. Of course it does. Swizzle it with a goddamn straw is what I'm gonna do. I'm just gonna stir it up. Thought I'd use my fancy jar that I got at, you know, Margaritaville in Cozumel. See a little skull and everything. I thought, this is a tropical drink. That'll work. Except the swizzle stick doesn't fit and the jar is almost too small for this much rum swizzle. So, while he did work in private practice some, by and large, his heart was in civil service, and he entered the State Senate of New York, the district he was from. There was three counties, Dutchess, something and something, I don't know. He was in Dutchess County, I don't remember what the other two were. It's on Wikipedia if you really want to look it up. And he was a senator from New York, senator from his district to the state capitol from 1910 to 1913. Now, when Wilson won the presidency in 1912, FDR was tapped to be the Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And from here, life gets really interesting. Oh, I should have had a rum swizzle while I was down there. I believe this was from a mojito. If I'd known that if they'd had rum swizzles, I would have gotten one. This is good. Okay, now when he was a state senator, he was kind of a snot. He was haughty and condescending. At least that's how Francis Perkins remembers him. Frances Perkins would eventually join his cabinet as Secretary of Labor. She would be the first woman to reach a cabinet-level position. But when they first met, he declined to assist her in getting state legislation passed that would limit women working more than 54 hours in a week. And he didn't care about labor until he could benefit from labor's votes, just like he didn't care about women's issues until he could get women's votes in 1920 with the passing of the 19th Amendment. That's down the line. When he was the Assistant Secretary of Navy, he was a pain in the ass to work with. He thought that the Secretary of Navy under William Sacknow, who was Josephus Daniels, was incompetent and that work only got done when he was the one doing it. Daniels, for his part, indulged FDR. He thought he was just an exuberant young man with high spirits. FDR was high-handed. And the author seemed to think that he was demonstrating leadership potential, But not, I don't know. I don't want to put words in the author's mouth because the book was very well written and well crafted. He was very careful to tell all sides of the story and not just the sides that would make FDR look good. And that's important to note because that's really hard to do, especially if you admire the topic of your book. I definitely get the sense that he does admire FDR as a person as a whole. And there's a lot to admire there, and we'll get back to that because there's also a lot to not admire, which we're going to cover. He's pretty unflinching in reporting FDR's fuck-ups and high-handedness. Like when the... when FDR used his position as the assistant SecNav to order the Navy to pick his children up from the family residence in Upper New York so that they could avoid public transport and thus the rampant polio epidemic that was gripping the nation at that point in time. One example of FDR using connections the average American did not have purely for his own advantage. Another time one of his kids was making a trip across country, and this was like right when the Depression was like smacking, right after FDR took office and he had ordered the banks to close while he figured out what to do with that. And so his kid literally ran out of money. So he phoned the local jurisdiction where the kid was traveling through and had the sheriff escort him to a hotel where the kid then got a room basically for free because he was the president's son. Just small things like that. Of those children, he had 6 total. 1 died in infancy. The 5 who made it to adulthoods were basically just a colossal mess. Like, none of them had marriages that lasted. All were divorced at least once. His oldest daughter, Anna, her second husband is known to have molested her teenage daughter by her first marriage. All of that's covered in the book. So, like, I'm not just pulling whispers off the internet here. This is stuff that was researched, documented, and reported in this book. After the birth of her 6th child, Eleanor, who was very Victorian, refused to have sex anymore. She was like, I don't want any more children. I'm not doing this ever again. She didn't want any more children, and she declined to explore any methods of birth control beyond abstinence. It's important to note that while hormonal birth control was not yet a thing, rubber condoms had been around since 1860. Refused to use them. The Roosevelts were not Catholic. There was no reason not to use them. It was widely believed back then and even through today that she did not care for sex. There's a vague possibility she may have been a lesbian. That's not really explored in the book. In fact, the author seems to think it was unlikely. She just happened to have friends that are lesbians.
We're not gay. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Am I throwing a Seinfeld clip there to reinforce that? There really isn't. But it's a possibility. She may have been. It may have been that she did find comfort in the arms of another woman, especially when, following her refusal to have any more children and her embrace of the abstinence lifestyle, Roosevelt did not follow her down that abstinence path, and he had several well-known affairs. Like, they were documented and known in his day, and they're certainly well-known now. The 2 most well-known were with Lucy Mercer, who later became Lucy Rutherford, and then Marguerite Missy LaHand. Mercer was initially Eleanor's social secretary, and Eleanor found out about this affair when FDR returned from the front during World War I. Not that he was actively serving, he never did, he never actually saw combat, but he toured the front during his time as the assistant SecNav and contracted the Spanish flu on the return trip. You know, the big one that killed millions of people, the actual pandemic of the 21st century, or 20th century, excuse me. And while he was convalescing at home, Eleanor was unpacking his luggage and found a packet of love letters between Mercer and FDR. Divorce was discussed. Eleanor was kind of leaning towards that. FDR might have had the chance to marry somebody that he loved and who enjoyed sex. But Sarah, FDR's mother, was against divorce. Promised to withhold funds from FDR if he proceeded to divorce. I don't remember what she used to induce Eleanor to stay, but Eleanor did stay. It was probably money. Mama Sarah used her power of the purse strings to control all the family members, from FDR through all 5 grandchildren. Eleanor was not exempt from that. Some of the most telling pieces of FDR were revealed during the author's discussions of FDR's interactions with his mother. Like, the author attributes FDR's skill in lying, no joke, totally developed by trying to sidestep his mother's edicts. Most of us outgrow the need to lie to our parents. Most of us. FDR never did. Eleanor, for her part, for agreeing to stay in the marriage, insisted that FDR never see Mercer again, which sort of happened. There's indication that they maintain like a writing relationship, you know, like a pen pal sort of thing. Mercer did eventually marry Winthrop Rutherford, but pretty much remained in love with FDR and was actually with him when he died in 1945. We're going to come back to that one. Now, La Hand was his longest-lasting affair. She was with FDR from 1921 until she experienced a stroke and was medically retired in June of 41. She eventually died in 1944. Right, so basically, from the time Mercer was out, La Hand was in, and was FDR, and FDR's sex life was really only down when he was actively fighting polio. Now, following his bout with the flu, FDR became embroiled in one of the biggest, most South Park-sounding scandals I had ever read. Like, my jaw dropped. Right? I don't even know what to do with this. I was seriously, like, just jaw on the floor. I'm like, seriously? The Navy Department in Newport, Rhode Island, started fielding reports that naval personnel were engaging in homosexual activity. Yes, the YMCA was literally mentioned in this chapter. It's been around for a while, and now I sort of know where the song came from. Now, these days, that's a big nothing burger. Who gives a flying fuck? It's more of a standing joke now, right? If you're gay, you join the Navy way. But 100 years ago, this was a career killer and criminal activity. Being gay could literally land you in prison. Being a lesbian wasn't much better, but being gay was a big no-no. So FDR approved, and I kid you not, he approved naval personnel actively engaging in gay activities to catch other people being gay.
Now, if you wouldn't mind handing over the $20 for oral sex. Okay. All right, buddy. Go ahead and unbutton your pants. All right, here we go.
I told you, it's totally South Park. And, like, signed memos and orders authorizing gay activities, but you will not be prosecuted if you testify against the people who are engaging in these activities with you. And when the sailors did catch other gay sailors by allowing those sailors to give them blowjobs and other activities, I feel like, hold on, I'm almost sure I'm blushing here. Fucking absurd. So when this came out in court, yes, this all came out in court, multiple times they tried to catch, I think a pastor specifically, who just kept going like, yeah, but how would they know unless they were gay? Sort of, that's his defense. It was eventually brought to the Senate Subcommittee on Naval Affairs, and FDR was called to task to explain why he authorized gay activities that were immoral and perverse to catch people engaging in gay activities that are immoral and perverse. And FDR tried to deny it, saying that he had no interest in how the Navy got results, only that they got results. Ultimately, this did not fly with the Senate back then. This was 21, so it was a heavily Republican Senate. And the Senate subcommittee determined that FDR's conduct was dishonorable and that he had abused the authority of his high office. Now, this all happened in like July of 1921. And within a month, FDR was down with polio. And I mean, like, a week after he got this smackdown from the Senate, he went on vacation, basically to lick his wounds to the Palisades of New York. He was swimming with the Boy Scouts. No gay jokes there. All right, it was just swimming with the Boy Scouts.
Hello, Scouts.
No more South Park. He was swimming with the Boy Scouts, fishing from his yacht, and he fell overboard and. His back started aching. Now, he thought that he may have just injured it, like pulled a muscle when he fell off the boat. He did not. This was his body's reaction to polio. And, I know, look, I still don't like FDR. He was never my favorite president anyways, and after reading this book, that hasn't changed. But I can admire the absolute strength and determination that it took to come back from a life-altering diagnosis like polio. I mean, in kids, it was terrifying. Children died from this, and they would have lifelong illnesses. You have the iron lung. I think I saw a thing where, like, the last polio survivor to live in an iron lung died recently. I mean, he lived, like, 87 years or something like that in an iron lung. And that was the only treatment they had for polio back then. The vaccine hadn't yet been invented. In a full-grown adult with a fully formed immune system, paralysis only afflicted, like, 1%. Of those who caught it. So he actually had very good odds of not being paralyzed, except he didn't, right? FDR was at 1% of adults who contracted polio and remained paralyzed. The paralysis initially went halfway up his abdomen, which was exceptionally dangerous because it could have paralyzed his lungs and diaphragm. Eventually it did recede, obviously, left him fully functioning with everything including sex, so he was able to enjoy his time with Missy LaHand. Just left him with damaged legs, which is, I don't mean to downplay that, it's not, all right? He worked very hard to regain the function that he did regain from his polio bout. But it certainly left him, like, wheelchairs were his easiest way of getting around. He could stand, he could walk with braces, but it wasn't comfortable. But he used that to his advantage, because watching him struggle like that and not bow in the face of it was inspiring. Absolutely inspiring. How could it not be? Here's somebody who's stricken down in the prime of his life, prime of health, right? Went from the pink of health to barely able to walk. Absolutely inspiring. And he used that to further his political career later. Don't blame him. No fault. No shame. No blame here. Good for him. Kids these days could probably learn from that. Instead of crying about being victims, he never cried about it. He just accepted it and moved on. In the intervening 7 years, this was the biggest time when he worked in the private sector. He did work for an insurance company, selling insurance at a wage of $25,000 a year, which was about $433,000 a year in today's currency. But he also, during this time, so from 1921 until 1928, he spent that time recuperating and trying to get back the use of his legs. Spent a good chunk of his time sailing in the Bahamas and enjoying the rum swizzles, which is why this is the cocktail of the week. They were legal in the Bahamas because the Bahamas did not have prohibition. I'm just realizing that this eye is way more blue than this eye. This eye. I don't know what to do with that. Well, nothing now. And when he got tired of sailing the Bahamas, he went to Warm Springs, Georgia, to a treatment center there, and found it so therapeutic. And this is where he regained most of the mobility that he did get, that when the original owner died, he bought it and turned it into a polio rehabilitation center. And then he spent that time working as an insurance salesman and working his way back into politics, eventually becoming governor of New York in 1928. Now, there was a lot of backdoor politicking there, and he had to learn to play nice with Tammany Hall in the interim. And when he won the governorship, the former governor, Al Smith, tried to wiggle his way in as kind of governor in reality with FDR as the figurehead, but FDR rejected that proposition and was governor for 4 years. He won his second term in 1930 before running for president in 32. Now, I don't want to spend too much. I'm not going to spend any time going over 32 to 40. We've covered a lot of that last month. I'm going to cover more of it next week when I read New Deal or Raw Deal. So I'm not going to cover that. But by 1940, World War II had started, right? 1939, September 30th, 1939, Hitler rolled into Poland and Europe was officially at war. The Eastern Front against Russia was heating up. FDR was not per se a fan of communism. In fact, he ordered FDR to watch communists and fascists. And while the book by Schles and McIlvaine both made it seem like one of his great saving graces is that he hated the Nazis, this book makes it perfectly clear that he really just hated Germans in general. He learned at his parents' knees that Germans were dirty subhumans, and he did not like Germany or Germans in general. And when he and Eleanor honeymooned in Europe, including Germany, they went to the spas there because his father liked the spas in Germany, even though Germans were dirty, nasty people. They were typically, bad 21st century rude Americans, typically bad guests. At one of the hotels they stayed at, there was a sign that said, "Please don't slam the doors," and they would deliberately slam the doors because they thought it was funny. So it's not that he didn't not like fascism. He just hated Germans. He just hated Germans in general. He hated Jews. He hated black people. He hated European power. One of his stated goals, which he managed quite ably during his talks with Stalin, was to break European colonial power. He had seen Europe draw the planet into two world wars. He didn't want them to have enough power to do it a third time, which is fair. That's an admirable goal. Instead, let's just have only two powers, the United States and the Soviet Union, and fight a proxy wars in third world countries. As long as it's not a first world Europe or in America or Russia, who cares? We're going to circle back to that one. Now, while president, he became the first president to use both the FBI and the IRS to take out political enemies. It's in the book. And to help his friends. He ordered J. Edgar Hoover to spy on communists and fascists in the United States, which was well outside the charter of the FBI. And J. Edgar Hoover pointed that out, said, "Hey, unless this is referred to me by the Department of State, I can't do anything about this." And so FDR ordered the Department of State to do exactly that. And so he did. and he authorized illegal wiretapping against political opponents. And when he interned the Japanese in California following the attack on Pearl Harbor, he ignored Hoover's advice that this was not necessary. J. Edgar Hoover, the boogeyman of the FBI, the people that liberals love to hate, said that interning the Japanese Americans was completely unnecessary off of information that he obtained through those illegal wiretaps. Roosevelt hated the Japanese. Hated them. Before World War II, he hated them. All right, and he used this as an opportunity to confiscate Japanese American lands and intern them. Japanese Americans were like, hey, whoa, wait, what about the, you know, German Americans and Italian Americans? And he's like, yeah, they're not the problem. You guys are. Tough luck. Shouldn't have been Japanese. He used the IRS to target Mo Annenberg. Annenberg was the publisher of the Philadelphia Inquirer, a paper that was critical of FDR's policies, and Annenberg was planning on filing a libel suit. A libel suit against Secretary of the Interior Harold Ickes, and was picked up on a wiretap, one of those illegal wiretaps, saying that if Ickes spoke at a planned rally in Philadelphia, Annenberg would, quote, get him. Now, this was read as intending bodily harm to a member of the cabinet, and there was no evidence that that was actually what he meant, but FDR used that as an excuse to have the IRS track down alleged gambling income for Annenberg in the amount of $6 million. Again, an enormous sum for back then, enormous sum for today, but an enormous sum back in the 1940s, which resulted in Annenberg being jailed for tax evasion. He served two-thirds of his sentence before being released on compassionate leave 2 weeks before he died of a brain tumor. On the other side of the coin, he ordered the IRS to stop pursuing criminal investigation and accept a delinquent payment for an up-and-coming young Democrat from the state of Texas, one Lyndon B. Johnson. Johnson had run in the 1941 Senate race in Texas and found some creative bookkeeping ways around violations of the Hatch Act. A criminal prosecution, if he had been found guilty, would have precluded him from running for public office in the future, including as vice president of one future JFK. FDR used his power as the president to shield him from that. Must be nice having an FDR in your corner. Not that the Republicans are any better. Trust me, they do their own shady shit. FDR was just the kicking off point for all of this garbage. Now, one thing that was informative and a pretty good defense, I mean, he did a good job in this. There's this belief and conspiracy theory going around that FDR knew Pearl Harbor was going to happen and did nothing to prevent it. Morgan does a pretty good job dispelling that myth, and I agree with the logic he laid out explaining why that wasn't so. And I do. Namely, that Pearl Harbor was a naval base, and FDR was a Navy man. I mean, he really embraced his role as secretary, as Assistant Secretary of Navy, and identified with the Navy. He when he was sailing around the Bahamas after his polio diagnosis, he was doing the sailing. He was genuinely somebody who was good with ships and yachts and boats and knew all about them, and I don't think he would have left Navy personnel to die intentionally had he known about it. Basically, what happened is we had all the pieces were there. All the puzzle pieces were there that something big was going to happen. But it's like each individual person was handed a piece of the puzzle. Like 60 people were handed individual pieces of the puzzle and then told to go in and put it where you think it fits in the picture. But there was no master picture for them to look at the piece and say, oh, okay, that matches that. It might go about here. They were just handed individual pieces and said, make it fit. Well, there was no way to make it fit. And so Pearl Harbor happened. Okay, so this review has gone on for a while. We're sitting at 30 minutes now. There's no way it's going to be less than 30 minutes. For 6 pages typewritten, I think I'm running on to 7, actually. There is a lot of information in this book. It's 774 pages. Let me see if I can wind this up. FDR had 2 in-person conferences with Churchill and Stalin. I mean, he had many face-to-face interactions with Churchill, but Stalin basically refused to leave his overarching fiefdom during the height of the fighting. So the first meeting was in Tehran, which was not quite in his fiefdom, but was closer than, you know, D.C. The second was in Yalta. Now, during both, the carving up of territories occurred, and FDR was all on board. He agreed with all of this. Because, again, he wanted to break up European power. At the Yalta Conference, which occurred just after his swearing-in, he was sworn in for his 4th term on January 20th, 1945, February 1945 was the conference at Yalta, and it was widely observed that FDR was ill. He looked ill. Everybody around him knew he was quite sick. Churchill's doctor took one look at him and commented that FDR was not long for this world, that he had like one foot in the grave. His illness had been known for a while. Running for his third term was an absolutely unprecedented political maneuver. There's a lot of rum in this. It's very good. By the time he ran for his fourth term, the Democratic Party knew that he would not make it through the whole term. But they also could not see just handing a victory to the Republicans, and they didn't have anybody else that would possibly win the votes. So they had him run and handpicked Harry Truman to be his running mate and the man to take over when FDR passed. I'm not sure why they picked Truman. I'm hoping it'll be in the book on Truman next month. But he was handpicked. Now, after he returned from Yalta, he signed a few bills, then went to Warm Springs, Georgia for a respite. He still owned that property down there where he was hoping to, you know, relax his legs and his back and get a little more mobility. He was always searching mobility. While there, his first mistress, Lucy Rutherford Nee Mercer, came for a visit brought with her a portraitist, since Lucy wanted a portrait of FDR for herself. And while sitting for the portrait, FDR, like, it was like the first sitting, right? She had barely taken sketches. She had taken a couple of measurements to get his nose right, that sort of thing. He complained of a vicious headache back here, which God knows I've had them, especially reading this book, before he just collapsed. Of course, the doctor was called immediately. He was diagnosed with cerebral hemorrhage, and he died, like, you know, 2 hours later. Now, Stalin believed that FDR had been assassinated via poison, and the closed casket funeral did not help that impression. It was closed because his face was literally purple because of all the blood from the cerebral hemorrhage. You know, cerebral, brain, head, hemorrhage, blood. Like, literally, blood veins burst back here. Eleanor, who had stuck by him even after the affair, was, well, quite hurt that the other woman was present when he died. Don't blame her. FDR is a complicated man. There is a lot to admire about him. There truly is. Right? I mean, yes, he was one of the landed elites. Polio in the prime of your life is by any metric, an earth-shattering diagnosis. And while somebody with a really strong immune system might have shrugged it off, like an adult might have shrugged it off, and in fact, most do, he did not. His immune system was never strong. He was always prone to catching colds. And it's not just the Spanish flu thing. A lot of people caught that. It's that after any sort of setback in his personal life, he tended to get ill. All right. And of course, being told that he had engaged in conduct unbecoming by the Senate Subcommittee on Naval Affairs weeks before his polio diagnosis didn't help. All right. Your mind can certainly play a part in how well you recover from something. And that literally knocked him off his feet. No pun intended. But he came back from that. He found a way to do more with this, with his life. He turned a polio diagnosis into a way to connect with people. On the other hand, I think he was a megalomaniac. All right? He ran for 4 terms. Who the fuck does that? 2 terms is usually enough for presidents to go, oh my God, what did I do to myself? Coolidge could have easily won a second term on his own right. Easily. All right, his first term was just completing out Harding's, and he was very popular. He was like, nah, I'm done. I don't want any more to do with this. The choice to run for a third term was strictly a power grab. It was a bucking of tradition and history. All right, the man who loved history decided to break the trends and run for a third term. And he was a hypocrite. He spent all of the 1930s denigrating and shaming businessmen. Right? They were the ones to blame. It was all their fault that we were in a depression. But once World War II happened and he needed that manufacturing capability, he turned his back on labor, issued several executive orders that they couldn't strike for whatever reason, and made connections with businesses to get that war machine revved up. And when he met with the major manufacturers, all but one of them were Republicans. That one, and I don't recall his name, and, you know, I looked, but I couldn't figure out which one of these tabbies I used to mark it out. I'm going to have to start getting a little more selective with my tabbies, especially in the big books. But the one that was a Democrat, when he was suggested by one of the other Republicans, you know, Roosevelt knew. He's like, hey, isn't he a Democrat? And the guy said, yeah, but he voted for Wilkie in the 1940 election. Wilkie, of course, being the Republican candidate. I mean, FDR in his time managed to drive a wedge into the heart of America, and he managed to profit from both sides of the divide that he created. He ran this country like it was his own personal kingdom and used executive orders to run the country. I mean, when the book I read a couple years ago on civil wars, I'll put it up here, right? I'm really bad at pointing, especially when I have this much rum in me. The Civil War book, the one that I lambasted, right? She bitched about how Trump used executive orders to run the nation. Honey, look at what FDR did. Do you have any idea how many executive orders he issued in his 10 years in office? I can say not even 10, because he died on April 12th, 1945. That was when he died. He used executive orders to run the country, and he used the FBI and the IRS as his own police force to attack political enemies and grant amnesty to his allies. I mean, I don't doubt he was a great man who did great things, but so was Voldemort, right? Had long-lasting implications to his policies. I mean, yes, no war has been fought in Western Europe since the end of World War II, but the Eastern Bloc was left in absolute shambles, and witnessed the 1990s, right? Proxy wars have been fought between the two remaining superpowers, America and Russia, in the intervening years. Ended with the collapse of the USSR in 1989. The Berlin Wall fell in 1991, I think, was when the Soviet bloc finished collapsing. That's what led to the rest of the wars in Eastern Europe. Left enough bodies in the wake of the mess that on September 11, 2001, America was attacked using suicide bombers flying planes into our buildings, resulting in over 3,000 American casualties. That action can be traced, historically, to FDR's willingness to look the other way in the face of Stalin, Jackson's in Russia. I mean, if we had not fought one of those proxy wars in Afghanistan, then 9/11 would not have happened. And if he had not gone with the lesser of two evils, if he had not embraced the enemy of my enemy is my friend mentality, then we might be in a very different world right now. This was not a case of picking the lesser of two evils, and Roosevelt knew. He knew. He had to know. The reason he had to know is that following the liberation of POW camps in Germany, American POWs were not released back to America. They were transferred to Russian POW camps, where word of what was happening absolutely reached Roosevelt before his death. So he knew. He just didn't care, because he was all about maintaining his own power base at the cost of we the people. Overall, this book was quite well written. It didn't include the bits about Afghanistan and all that, because this book was written in 85. Yes, Afghanistan had happened, but obviously 9/11 had not. The Berlin Wall had not even fallen when this book was written. But it was quite well written. It really was. I mean, 170 pages a day is not an easy feat to manage, you know, unless you're a speed reader, which I'm really not. But I managed it quite ably. And you get the sense the author genuinely admired FDR, but he also doesn't sugarcoat the man's failings. And there was a lot of very uncomfortable, not very PC language in the book. I mean, not even PC for 1985 when the book was written. But I very much admire the author's ability to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth, even when it was less than flattering to his subject matter. And that's it for this week. When I edit this, I'll try and get it down to maybe 35 minutes, but the official recording is sitting at 41 now, so you'll be editing out the ums and ahs. It'll probably be around 38. And if you like what you saw, don't forget to subscribe, share my videos. I'll see you guys next week. Bye.